the organizers for inviting me here to speak in front of you today. So why don't I just begin with some of the notation that I'll maintain throughout this talk, and hopefully this will be very familiar to you. So the setting that we're in, so we start with a phenomenon algebra M. That's a subset of the space of bounded operators on a Hilbert space, and you assume it's closed under addition, multiplication, or composition. Taking the adjoint, you make sure it contains the identity operator, and you assume it's closed in this sigma-strong topology, which is given by describing when a net converges. Alternatively, by the double commutant theorem, you can... This is all equivalent to saying that M is equal to M double prime. You could replace sigma strong with strong, weak, sigma weak. These are all equivalent. I just wanted to put that up because I want to have a linear functional phi, which is continuous when M has a sigma strong topology, and that's called it being normal. You assume it's positive, which is that condition right there. You have a normalization condition. And you assume that it's tracial, which means that when you apply phi to a product x, y, it doesn't matter which way you write it. And lastly, I'm going to have self-adjoint elements a1 through an. So this is my setup, and I'm always going to maintain this notation. So I have three things. I have a phenomenon algebra M. I have a tracial normal state phi, and I have an n-tuple of self-adjoint elements in my phenomenon algebra M. And... Well, I'll just write up the canonical example that I'm thinking of. It's already been described. What you do is you start out with a group G, and for each element G and G, you associate the unitary operator U sub G, and its action is governed by the following. Where F is an element, little L2 of G. So these are square summable functions on G. And now you take these unitary operators, UG, all of them, and you take the phenomenon algebra they generate. That's what I mean when I write this double commu, this double prime. And this is called the group phenomenon algebra generated by G. So this is contained in the bounded operators on L2G. So that gives me the first part, and if I want to put a linear functional on it, then all I do is, if you give me an element x in this group phenomenon algebra, then I just watch what it does to the characteristic function over the identity, and I inner product with it. And phi is a normal tracial state, just like condition 2 right there. So that's a canonical example, and what we're really interested in is when G is a free group a free group. So that's a free group on N generators. And the object that we're really interested in is when G is replaced with Fn, and those are called the free group factors, and those are objects of primary interest. Okay. So everything I'm going to talk about now, until otherwise stated, has been done by Voicălescu. This concept of microstates, free entropy, and free entropy dimension. So instead of continuing to say Voicălescu proved this, just everything in green, more or less, will be done by Voicălescu unless stated otherwise. So you have this n-tuple, and I want to somehow describe the behavior of this n-tuple under its relation with phi, and I'm going to do that by looking at n-tuples of matrices, which somehow approximate that behavior. So what you do is you start out with R gamma mk, as written above, And MSA sub KC are the set of K by K self-adjoint complex matrices. And when I put an N right there, then I mean the set of N tuples of elements in the self-adjoint K by K matrices over C. This symbol right here will be the normalized Hilbert-Schmidt norm on the K by K matrices. And so I have all these quantities, R, gamma, M, K. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to define this set of N-tuples of matrices. So this is gamma R, A1 through AN, MK gamma. And it's a set of all N-tuples of K by K self-adjoint matrices such that they approximate the behavior of the A1 through ANs under phi. So here what we're doing is we're looking at these N-tuples of matrices and we're trying to match what they do under the trace, the normalized trace on the K by K matrices, and compare that to phi. Okay, so more specifically, what the M and gamma do is they somehow describe to what degree this approximation is going on. So you can choose a string of X1 through XNs. So you choose these indices, I1 through IQ, and Q does not exceed M. You can string them together, and you take the K by K trace of them, and you demand that it's no more than gamma from phi, applied to the same monomial, I1 through IQ. That's what it is. So I'm somehow trying to approximate the behavior of this N-tuple living in a infinite dimensional object with something very finite dimensional. Okay. So this is called a microstate for the N-tuple A1 through AN. And now if I have a P-tuple of elements in M, then I can define a smaller set of elements, which I've written like this. And it consists of all N-tuples, X1 through XN, such that there exists a corresponding Y1 through YP-tuple, such that when I join them together, then it provides a microstate for A1 through AN, B1 through BP, according to those approximations. So what this is roughly saying is that there exists some P-tuple which is going to witness, in relation to the first N-tuple, the same relations that A1 through AN and B1 through BP have. Okay. So, like I said before, we're somehow trying to approximate this with finite dimensional building blocks. And what you can do with finite dimensional stuff, you can do quite a bit, and one of those things is to take volumes. So that's all I'm going to do. I'm going to start taking volumes of these sets. I'm going to apply a lot of limits, a lot of lim sups or lim imps or not limits, but a lot of limits to somehow get to some number which will represent asymptotically the volume of this N-tuple. Okay, so how do I get the volume? Well, I look at my N-tuple of self-adjoint K by K matrices as a real vector space with respect to this inner product right here. It's a natural inner product, or the norm, the inner product generated by that norm. And so you have Lebesgue measure when you look at this as a Euclidean space. And it's the kind of Lebesgue measure which reacts properly with this unnormalized Hilbert-Schmidt norm. And then you start wiping out constants. So you add all these unpleasant constants. You add R, you add K, you add M, and you add gamma. And I want to get rid of all of them and somehow come up with one number which will represent the volume of this N-tuple. So this is what you do. First, let's get rid of the K. K is the size of the matrices, right? We're approximating them by N-tuples of K by K matrices. Because your N-tuple lives in an infinite dimensional object, you're going to have to let K grow bigger and bigger in order for it to approximate it properly. So to get rid of K, you do this right here. You take the volume. You're going to have to apply the logarithm because you're going to want to wipe out a dimensional constant of K squared. And you have this normalization constant, which actually occurs because you're dealing with balls. That's what really happens. If you start computing volumes of balls of radius 1 in higher dimensions, you'll see exactly why this constant needs to be there. But if you forget about that, then we're just sort of taking the volume of the microstates and applying whatever functions are necessary to make sure that it somehow stays within bounds. Okay, so you get rid of the k, and now what you want to do is you want to get rid of the m and gamma, which means you want your microstates to approximate in a finer and finer fashion. So you just do that, which is saying that your approximations are getting better and better. Now, finally, you have one constant left, which is the R. So you take the largest of the chi R's. It appears that by recent work of Berkovici that you don't even need the R. But I'm still waiting to get a copy of that paper. But it looks like you don't need the R for this quantity, which was an open question for a while. Okay, so now you've done this whole thing. You've applied this huge process to this n-tuple. And now this quantity is called the free entropy of A1 through AN. So roughly speaking, it's a logarithmic volume of an n-tuple. That's what you've done. You've taken, in some approximate way, the logarithmic volume of this. And if you just instead of having these... this B1 through BP here, if you get rid of that and just have chi R of A1 through AN, and you replace this with gamma R A1 through AN and MK gamma. So if you get rid of the B1 through BPs and you apply the same process, then you have what's called the free entropy of A1 through AN. So again, free entropy is like logarithmic volume. That's the attitude we want to take here. Okay, so Voicălescu went further, and he actually defined something which seems even hairier, because this process seems massive at first. I was very frustrated when I first read about this for at least a week, I think. So there's another notion called free entropy dimension of the n-tuple A1 through AN, and it's represented by the symbol delta naught. And what you do is you take the number of random variables, or the number of self-adjoint elements, n, and to that you add this quantity here. And again, let's read chi as the logarithmic volume. So to the A1 through AN, you've added epsilon, a very small number, times a semicircular perturbation. And you always do this in the presence of S1 through SN. So I hope most of you know what a semicircular family is. I don't have time to go through what that is, but they're more or less generators of L of Fn. So I hope you're okay with that. But if you're not, it's okay. There's a result that I want to talk about, which says you don't necessarily have to think about that if you don't want to. Okay, so delta naught is a scary looking thing at first. So let me tell you about the motivation. Voicălescu called this something reminiscent of Minkowski content. So let me remind you what that is. You start with any subset in Euclidean space, and what you do is you look at this quantity. So you take the dimension of the ambient space, RD, and to that you take a lim sup as epsilon goes to zero of the logarithmic volume of the epsilon neighborhood of the subset. Just as if we read chi as a logarithmic volume, we're doing the same thing. The only difference here, the cautionary thing, is that instead of taking an epsilon neighborhood, you're taking a semicircular perturbation. So you're not taking a neighborhood precisely, right? It's something a bit more complicated, possibly. Okay. Well, this turns out to be the same thing as a packing number description, which is given by that expression right there. So, P epsilon of S is the following number. It's the maximum number of points you can place in the subset S, such that any two points are at least epsilon separated. You can replace P epsilon with N epsilon. N epsilon is the minimum number of balls of radius epsilon required to cover the set. For asymptotic reasons, they're absolutely the same. And this has a number of names. It's box dimension, Kolmogorov dimension. Anyway, you can describe Minkowski content in terms of packing numbers or volumes of epsilon neighborhoods. And that's really all I wanted to say about that for right now. Now, let me just tell you about a couple of the properties of delta naught. The first is subadditivity. The second very important property is that delta naught respects freeness. So there's an algebraic relation called freeness, and when you have an n-tuple which is free, then delta naught becomes additive on that n-tuple. In fact, more is true. It's not just delta naught which becomes additive, but chi, logarithmic volume, becomes additive on an n-tuple. Just as an advertisement, that uses random matrices. So this is a conference on random matrices. I don't say anything about that explicitly, but Voicalescu's proof uses random matrices to prove this, the fact that chi is additive. And this third property just is a formula about what would happen if you took the free entropy dimension of a single self-adjoint. So what you do there to compute that is you take a look at phi and you restrict it to the spectrum of A, and that yields a Borel measure. And you take one and you subtract the sum of the squares of the atoms of the Borel measure. Okay. So that's the formula. Now, the reason why this delta naught and this chi might be important and has already proven to be important in the framework of Feynman algebras is you want to know when two Feynman algebras are isomorphic, star isomorphic, basic problem, classify all of them, or just classify ones with normal tracial states. And some people have speculated that delta naught might be an invariant of Feynman algebras. So what do I mean by that? Delta naught is something defined on an n-tuple of self-adjoint variables, right? Well, there is a conjecture out there which says that if you take any two sets of generators for the same Feynman algebra with a trace, then are they equal or not? And so that's the question. And notice this, they generate the same Feynman algebra. That's the tricky part. It's the closure. It's what happens when you suck in all those operators that may not be in the algebra. Now, it is known that if you take two sets which generate the same algebra, then equality does hold. So, what can you actually do with delta naught? Well, a couple old operator algebra questions were actually solved using delta naught. Voicalescu actually showed that the free group factors did not have a regular diffuse hyperfinite subalgebra. And later, Liming-Ge actually showed that they're prime. And what they did in both cases to do that was they showed the following. So they wanted to show that the free group factors didn't have a certain decomposability. So what they did was they said, take that property, take a Feynman algebra and suppose it has this property. Suppose it can be decomposed in a certain way. Then for any self-adjoint generators, A1 through AN, what they showed was that delta naught of A1 through AN was less than or equal to 1. That's what they did. So they said, suppose a Feynman algebra has a good decomposability property, take any set of self-adjoint generators for it, and then they showed that it was less than or equal to 1, the free entropy dimension. But using stuff that Voicalescu has proven about freeness, you can actually show that if you have a family of n random variables, which are semicircular and free, then their free entropy dimension is n. So you take n semicircular elements in a free group factor, this L of Fn that I wrote up there, and using free probability, you can show that the free entropy dimension is in fact n, and that means that the Feynman algebra generated by this could not possibly have the decomposability property that you wished for. right? Because if you know this result for any set of generators of a Feynman algebra with a good decomposability property, then it follows that the free group factors could not have that. So, for example, by Liming-Goh's result, you cannot write the free group factor on two generators as a tensor product of itself. That's one corollary of Goh's result. So that's, I think that was an open problem for quite some time. So free entropy dimension has already done some important things. And so that more or less concludes the review. And let me just tell you quickly about the results. Okay, so I kept muttering something about packings, right? I said, here's free entropy dimension delta naught. It's this hairy thing with semicircular perturbations, and it's inspired by Minkowski content. Minkowski content can in turn be described through packing. So all I want to do now is write down an analogous formula between delta naught and a packing formulation, and it goes as follows. So that's more or less what I said. Okay, so what you do is, for any k in n, you define this natural Euclidean metric, and notice that it's already normalized. So I'm using the normalized Hilbert-Schmidt. And now I use this, hopefully this it feels a bit more comfortable now. This n epsilon xd is the minimum number of epsilon balls required to cover x. P epsilon xd is the maximum number of points in n epsilon separated subset of x with respect to the metric d. And now what I want to do is I want to start doing the same logarithmic process. This time, instead of using volume, I'm going to use the packing number. So this is all I do. Notice there's a log here and a k to the negative 2, just like with chi. So I'm taking the epsilon packing number of this microstate space according to these two approximations with respect to this metric, which is that natural Euclidean metric. Okay. So there I got rid of the k in the first step. And now I'm going to get rid of the m and the gamma. And now I'm just going to get rid of the r. And voila, that's going to be called the epsilon packing number of the n-tuple a1 through an. Similarly, you can define the minimum, the covering, epsilon covering number of this n-tuple. And the not-so-surprising result is that this delta naught that you started out with these epsilon semicircular perturbations, is the same thing as the packing number description. The proof of this is intuitively very simple. You just use a classical proof, and to that you add Voicalescu's asymptotic freeness result, which I said this before at some point, but in my mind it's one of the most spectacular theorems of free probability. What it roughly says is if you randomly choose two matrices, then they're going to be very much, well, they're going to be trying very hard to be free with respect to one another. That's what the strength and asymptotic freeness result is, and it's very, very powerful. It's what gives you additivity of chi, and it gives you a number of other things, and in particular, it also gives you this packing formulation of what delta naught should be. And this isn't that important, so I think I'll just skip that for the sake of time. Okay, so that's free entropy dimension, and now I'm just going to talk about hyperfinite Feynman algebras. So there is this question of invariance. A hyperfinite Feynman algebra is just a Feynman algebra which is the strong closure or the sigma strong closure of an increasing unit of union of finite dimensional algebras. So I hope that's familiar to you. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that A1 through AN are self-adjoint elements and that they generate a hyperfinite Feynman algebra in M. And I'm going to call that hyperfinite Feynman algebra N. And now you can really just decompose N. So I want to look at its atomic part and its diffuse part. So M0 is going to be the diffuse part of your hyperfinite Feynman algebra. And then you're going to have all these matricial parts, if any at all. You might not have any. It just might be diffuse. Or you might not have a diffuse part M0. And then you decompose phi, which is this tracial state on M, with respect to this decomposition. And now I would advise you not to read anything in the paragraph below, because that's what it more or less says concerning what these indices are. Because you have to be somewhat careful whether M0 is even there. It might just be a direct sum of matrices. It might just be a diffuse part. And you do the appropriate thing in each of these cases. So this is just breaking up N again into its matricial part and its diffuse part. That's all this is saying. And now, once you decompose N as such, the second result that I wanted to talk about was that the free entropy dimension of this N tuple is 1 minus this sum right here. So it's 1 minus the sum from I equals 1 to S of alpha I over KI, and you square both the numerator and denominator. And the alpha I and the KI appears as above. Now, this number, only depends on the algebra. I assumed nothing about the self-adjoint generators. Okay, so implicitly what this is saying is that delta naught is an invariant for hyperfinite Feynman algebras. And so it answers in a trivial case whether delta naught is as strong as it should be. But, of course, there are lots more Feynman algebras than just the hyperfinite ones. And the remark more or less says that, and it says that if you start computing the free entropy dimension for these finite dimensional algebras, for example, for the hyperfinite 2-1, it's 1. For the K by K matrices, it's 1 minus 1 over K squared. And all of these numbers agree with Ken Dykema's work in his PhD thesis, where what he was doing was he was taking free products of matrices or finite dimensional algebras, and he wanted to see what he would get at the end. And he started defining a number called the free dimension for these hyperfinite Feynman algebras. And he was hoping that somehow when he took these free products, free dimension would become additive on it. Now, this free dimension only made sense on hyperfinite Feynman algebras, but fortunately, the free entropy dimension and his number, free dimension, coincide. So that's just a side note if you're interested in taking free products. Okay, and the last result is hyperfinite monotonicity. So what that says is that if you have self-adjoint generators B1 through BP for M, and if you know that B1 through BP has finite dimensional approximants, so let's stop right there. What do I mean by this? I just mean that you actually have good n-tuples of matrices which approximate B1 through BP. Remember in this definition where I was dealing with the microstate space, I said look at all n-tuples which approximate the behavior of the AIs under their trace. Well, it's an open question whether you even have any matrices. So maybe there are weird operators out there which no n-tuple of matrices could possibly approximate, and that's Kahn's embedding problem. So this assumption is more or less saying that I'm going to go ahead and assume that you have good matricial approximants for it. Okay, so assume that, and assume that you have a unital inclusion of Feynman algebras, N and M, and let's assume that N is hyperfinite. So given all that, then free entropy dimension is monotonic. So the free entropy dimension of B1 through BP is greater than or equal to delta naught of N. And this expression on the left-hand side, it makes sense because of result 2, because free entropy dimension of a hyperfinite Feynman algebra makes sense. It's the free entropy dimension of any of its self-adjoint generators. And so in this situation where I was talking about the decomposability of certain Feynman algebras, where Ge and Voicalescu showed that if a Feynman algebra has, for example, a regular diffuse hyperfinite Feynman algebra, or it can be actually written as Well, it can be generated by certain hard unitaries which have a nice property. They showed in each of these cases that if you pick any set of self-adjoint generators, the free entropy dimension is less than or equal to 1. Well, these are all going to be diffuse for Neumann algebras by this decomposability property that I've just stated, either 1. And because they're diffuse, you can pick a single self-adjoint element which has free entropy dimension 1, which has no eigenvalues. And now the free entropy dimension formula for a single self-adjoint says that the free entropy dimension of that element is 1. And the commutative for Neumann algebra is certainly hyperfinite. So in all these situations, you actually get that delta naught of A1 through AN is greater than or equal to 1 by result 3. And so in all these situations, delta naught is also has been shown to be an invariant. So if you could so the free entropy dimension of this Neumann algebra right here is 1. If your Neumann algebra has a regular diffuse hyperfinite subalgebra, then it's also going to be 1. In fact, actually, Goh's result also shows that if you look at the group SL3Z, then the free entropy dimension of this thing is also 1. In fact, all the group for Neumann algebras associated with SLNZ, they're all 1 by his result. So the question's still out there whether delta naught is in fact an invariant for Neumann algebras. So I think that's it.